Hello, and welcome to episode 75 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Atlanta, Georgia, I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Sarah Richardson, professor of the history of science and of studies of women, gender, and sexuality at Harvard University. A historian and philosopher of science, Sarah is a leading scholar of gender and science whose work argues for conceptual rigor and social responsibility in scientific research on sex, gender, sexuality, and reproduction. Sarah directs the Harvard Gender Sci Lab, a collaborative interdisciplinary research lab dedicated to generating concepts, methods, and theories for biomedical research on sex and gender. Sarah's latest book, The Maternal Imprint, The Contested Science of Maternal Fetal Effects, charts the untold history of the idea that a woman's health and behavior during pregnancy can have long-term effects on her descendants' health and welfare. Tracing a genealogy of ideas about heredity and maternal fetal effects, this book offers a critical analysis of conceptual and ethical issues, in particular the staggering implications for maternal well-being and reproductive autonomy provoked by the striking rise of epigenetics and fetal origin science in post-genomic biology today. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Sarah. Dr. Sarah Richardson, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Very happy to be here.
Oh, thank you for joining us. So you're reaching out from Cambridge, is that right?
Yes, I'm in Cambridge on one of those classic days that is like mixed weather.
Somewhat sunny, somewhat cloudy.
Yeah. Yeah. Somewhat rainy, somewhat sleety.
I hear you. Are you having any teaching going on today? Anything happening?
Not today. This semester I'm teaching a big sort of general education course on gender and science. We're one third through the class, having just finished the unit on women in science, marching through about 400 years of that history and crunching a lot of the current scholarship in sociology and psychology and other empirical sciences, looking at women and science issues.
Fantastic. How is the class getting along? Is this something that you've taught before, have put some thought into?
Yeah, I have taught this class for years and I've put a lot of thought into it. And it's a really dynamic class in part because the student population just keeps diversifying and mm-hmm. changing and demanding to see their own stories in the course and their own experiences. The course is also taught, the course is also taken by primarily women and gender minorities who are in science. And so the information in it is sort of, it's vital. They're there because it's vital for their lives and the careers that they hope to build. And So when I teach the class, I'm just ear to the ground, sort of hearing about their experiences and their needs. And it's an amazing learning experience for me as well.
What are some of the things that's a really interesting response. What are some of the things you've learned from your students, perhaps over the years?
Sometimes I tend to present a rosy picture because with the long historical perspective, I'm able to show amazing progress and transformations in this institution
good.
That looks so inertial and that looks so patriarchal and so closed to change. And my students are quick to tell me there are still mm-hmm. big problems. And they come seeking a vocabulary for articulating those problems. And then, as I mentioned, science is diversifying, and it is not acceptable to them to tell a history of science that is just a Western history and that is just a history that features the few elite women, mostly white women from upper classes, who have been able to succeed in science at different times. That is not a satisfactory story. So increasingly, we must attend, if we can't tell the stories of diverse people in science, we have to tell the story of how the absence is there, right?
Right. So are there any, you know, particular, do you bring in any current papers, contemporary work into the idea? Or I guess, how would you frame it in terms of current problems versus this, you know, historical overview?
Well, one of the frames I use for that comes from Banu Subramaniam, who is a feminist science studies scholar, a scholar of race, gender and science, and an evolutionary biologist by training, who in her book, Ghost Stories for Darwin, writes about the confounding experience of being an Indian woman in science and sort of experiencing at multiple levels, both the pressure to succeed and to be a woman in science in a particular frame, and the subtle and sometimes murky ways in which sexism and racism really pervades the cultures, especially the cultures of training and mentorship and apprenticeship along the long journey to becoming a scientist, sort of the enculturation. So the frameworks that I arrive at in this unit of the course, and we cover other things,
of course,
but in this unit of the course, really try to introduce this notion of culture, the cultures of science, as ultimately being this really hard to transform, sticky, and hard to characterize and study using standard, say, quantitative measures. And that is really where we are with the gender and science debate. So yeah, or the women in science debate. And so we at the end we're reading narratives and we're sort of thinking about what kinds of transformations and interventions might be necessary to move the conversation forward.
That sounds like a wonderful course. I hope it's going. It sounds like it's getting off to a good start, and it sounds like it's evolving as the needs of the times come. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested to hear more about your teachings and more about your research, more about the Gender SciLab and the kind of work you've been doing in this. But why don't we take a step back first to figure out how you came to be teaching at Harvard, studying, doing some really great work in the history and philosophy of science. So, Sarah, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in Billings, Montana, also partly in the Washington, D.C. area where my family moved when I was in high school. I had an incredible experience growing up in that part of the world, a place of incredible natural beauty and great freedom, a lot of connection with nature. I very much identify as a Montanan, and that's important. Being from the West and having grown up in those landscapes is important to me. My identity.
Montana is a very special place. I have some family that happens to have some had a cabin up in West Yellowstone, Montana, out there. So the Southwest Idaho tip, but. Making it out quite a bit. There's something about the natural landscape, the expansiveness of it, the fresh air. There's something that I don't know. It's pretty unique in the United States. So,
yeah, I think I had a very independent and very creative childhood, sort of making do in that world and that landscape.
So, what were you interested in growing up? What did you find yourself spending your spare time doing?
I was a pretty bookish kid. I loved books and words. And also a very physical kid. Definitely, I was a gymnast. I was outside. I was a skier. Yeah. So always moving.
Where would you guys go skiing?
Oh, I grew up skiing at Bridger Bowl outside of Bozeman. My family had a cabin there.
Very nice.
Bridger Bowl ski area, which now is like one, like moving up in the world as a top ski area, but at the time it was a family ski resort. And you know, and just an incredible place. So yeah. A lot of snow time.
Very nice. So books, activities, things. I see you're adorning a really cool cycling sweatshirt. I imagine, is that something you're into these days?
I love to bike. So I think I had an active childhood.
And pretty big switch to DC then, switching over into high school. That's like, if you were to think of the opposite of Montana, maybe New York City or something, but. Yeah, that was a big change.
A really big change. I mean, I'm being melodramatic, but for a kid at that age, my mother was from DC and wanted to return to family. And that was a big transformation. I mean, I went to then a big, fancy public high school in the suburbs of DC where other students just had a life I just never had friends like this. They had traveled the world. They spoke many different languages. They were racially and ethnically diverse in ways I hadn't encountered before. And they came from extremely moneyed backgrounds, their houses, their it was a whole different, I had to learn a whole different language. And I mean, to be honest, so it was good in the sense that I think the high school probably gave me a lot of opportunities, that educational opportunities that I may not have gotten in Billings, and it opened me up to other kinds of worlds. But sometimes I felt as if I'd been practically transplanted to a whole other culture, speaking a whole other language.
I can imagine. And I imagine, you mentioned this sort of diversity, like back in Billings, was it kind of, did you have a lot of space? Was where you lived, or was it a suburban area where all the kids kind of not the same, so to speak, but everyone had similar, was a lot of more, it sounds like it's a lot of differences.
Yeah. I mean, Billings, was far more, of a working, working class town, the ethnic, cultural and ethnic diversity was mostly situated around Native American cultures. So in fact, my father worked most of his work, he's a geographer, most of his work was with the Cheyenne and Crow Indian tribes and reservations, which had, that's the work that brought our family out there. And so that was like the worldview. And, the fellow students in my school were, on the school lunch program. And, my family was solidly middle class, but we were like one of the richest families there, right? Like and my friends, so I was just acquainted with, and it was normal, for to be at a friend's house and there not to be food in the house, or there to be just very different expectations for what a like kid's birthday party would be or something like that. So it was quite a class shock. I am Jewish, and I had never met another like Jewish person. And when I moved to the DC area, most of my fellow students identified as Jewish. So just a different landscape and set of cultural background.
Absolutely. No, wow. I mean, it's a big change, but perhaps I imagine it's always fascinating to me, like where we grow up and how that informs our thinking and how that informs our just experience and then connection with other people and perhaps the things that we become interested in studying or just doing with our time. So, studying and work studying at a fancy public high school in DC. What were you? What caught your interest? What did you want to be when you grew up in high school?
Well, in high school, I immediately got drawn into debate. Mm. I imagine this is a common trajectory for philosophers. I don't know. I walked into a room, was invited into the activity, and basically immediately started trouncing everybody. I didn't know I had these skills. And so very quickly just kind of started rocking it and getting pulled into the activity. Yeah. And I went to summer camps. I traveled all over the country. Senior year, I was one of the top debaters in the country in Lincoln Douglas. I did all the round robins. I won some of them. I won some big tournaments. And I absolutely loved that. I would sit with my note cards and my piles of books and spend time in the college libraries in DC researching the topic. We didn't have really a strong debate team, so I just used the name of the school and traveled on my own and did my own debate prep and all of that. We didn't have a coach or anything like that.
Yeah, so would you compete individually in some way
under the name of my school, but pretty much did it on my own. We weren't like one of these big debate schools that had a coach traveling and a team. We didn't have any policy team or anything like that. I had a ball doing that. That was my main activity. I worked throughout high school. I taught gymnastics. I worked at the Discovery Zone at the mall. I babysat. I was on the gymnastics team at my high school. I'm trying to remember if I was involved in anything else.
What were your events, or was it like an all around? What did you do?
Oh, you compete in everything.
Literally,
my
everything.
Strongest event was beam.
Very nice. Okay. Well, sounds like a lot of great activities and a lot of great interests. And yeah, so debate. So those who want to do debate professionally, you're right. They go into a few different fields. Could be law. It could be science. It could be business. I mean, there's just, you know, if you can argue effectively and reason effectively, you can do lots of different things. So what, in terms of an introductory to study, was there sort of an expectation or an interest that you wanted to go on to university to study, to do something? Like, what were the next steps?
In my family, it was always considered, I was never pressured educationally. My parents did not look down over my shoulder at whether I had homework to do or whether, what grades I was getting or anything like that. I simply took it upon myself to apply to colleges. I decided I wanted to live in New York. Because my family growing up in Billings, Montana, had always subscribed to The New Yorker. And I would read it every week. I would read the list of events and the art galleries and all of that. And I thought, I want to live in New York sometime. And so I only applied to one school. Thank goodness I got in. I went to Columbia.
Fantastic.
I went in planning to be a philosophy major. Briefly thought maybe I should do urban studies. They actually have excellent urban studies program. I've just long been interested in urban landscapes and little spaces and all of that.
Definitely
went back to philosophy.
Which department is like an urban studies department housed in?
I think there's actually at Columbia, it being a very urban school, they have an urban studies program. It's kind of maybe unique in that. And they have a lot of, you know, very cool people. So I briefly fantasized about that and remain interested in those things. Columbia actually is, you spend most of your time completing the core curriculum that everybody does. So in the first 2 years, you just take art history and contemporary civilization and literature humanities and
comprehensive whole range of stock education.
It's known for that. So you just, the major is you only have a few years to do it. Most people don't like double major or anything. And I thought I was going to go on to law school. That was sort of the thought.
Sure.
Given that I like to argue,
right,
and debate,
and you're paid so well, and you do so, you know, there's so many great things that can come from, and it just, and there's a lot of reward from practicing law, I imagine.
Oh yeah, well, I was always committed to social justice issues, and I wanted to advocate, and I wanted to change, and I wanted things, and I wanted to move power, and law is an amazing profession for that. It really gives you some tools to make those changes.
Yeah. So what happened? So
really, no, I know what happened was I went after college to work on a big political campaign in Montana. I was the assistant to the campaign manager for a $10 million senatorial reelection campaign for Max Baucus, who was at the time, the five-term senator from Montana, senior senator from Montana. It was an amazing experience. I worked in a variety of campaigns and elections in that time right after college, but that experience had me working closely with a number of people who had built lives in politics, in activism, in law, who were female attorneys. And I had several times those women sort of take me aside and say, don't do it. Don't do a career in law. And they told terrible stories, and they told, they really tried to dissuade me. Actually. I was one time hiking on a mountain in Montana, literally on the Bearcooth Plateau. Yeah. And I was thinking, I was all set. I was preparing for the LSAT. I had my LSAT study books and all of that. And I guess I just thought, you know, I had sort of caught the bug my senior year of college of philosophy of science, history of science, social studies of science. And I thought, I really just want to learn how to write. I really want to learn how to write. I want to continue reading. I'm curious about this mysterious thing where people spend a life reading and writing. And I had figured out that you could go get a PhD and that it actually could be funded for 5 or 6 years. And so I threw out the LSAT prep book and went in and took the GRE. Instead of the LSAT, they're closely aligned. And it was sort of a last minute decision, and then applied to PhD programs instead.
Fair enough. I mean, it's a story that I've heard a little bit deciding between the two, but I mean, it's interesting to think about that and understand. Yeah. I mean, making those decisions is not easy. And I've definitely had those discussions from other lawyers who tell me to do, I don't know that. Some folks are happy with it. Some folks are not. So fair enough. You have to listen to what draws you. So you applied to study, and you studied at Stanford. Is that right?
Yeah, I applied to philosophy programs, to women and gender studies programs, to interdisciplinary programs that had a record of producing really interesting scholars in basically critical science and technology studies. My first advisor at Stanford, who was Lanier Anderson before I moved to Helen Longino, who arrived a year after I arrived, told me, well, what you do really is a philosophically inflected feminist science studies. And I was like, you nailed it. That is what
like it's everything. Yeah.
And so I was admitted to a variety of those programs and ultimately chose modern thought and literature at Stanford. It gave me considerable independence to build a program of study where I could get serious science training and work with some very top people in gender studies of science. I worked with Helen Longino and Londa Schiebinger. It's a pretty power-packed committee in that field. And I also worked with Michael Friedman there, and had many other advisors who weren't formally on my committee, who were just very generous toward this interdisciplinary approach. And I think Stanford, it's just a great place for a broad-minded picture of what philosophy of science can be. And I felt embraced and welcomed as this scholar from modern thought and literature in the philosophy world there, and was also able to take advantage of sort of the vibe of Silicon Valley, of Stanford, and the Genome Project kind of moment that was going on at the time, Stanford being a key site for that, and just hook into some amazing networks of scientists. Joan Roughgarden was a mentor to me there, Marcus Feldman. So it just was a wonderful place for doing exactly the sort of engaged philosophy of science I wanted to do, with this inflection from feminist science studies.
Yeah, and you mentioned the term. You said you're doing gender gender studies of science, or it was gender. I forget exactly how you put it, but it wasn't exactly just describing what you were up to or what was going on there as philosophy of science. So, how would you describe this approach to doing? I forget exactly how you framed it, but gender, whatever the framing was.
Lanier Anderson told me, I am doing philosophically inflected feminist science studies. Okay. Is that it?
Perhaps. Yeah.
I have held on to that. Yeah.
Right. Or just the focus, it's not particularly necessarily gender studies, but it's a, or perhaps it is gender studies of science, perhaps. And it's just, and so I was curious about that because from our university at Indiana University, we have a pretty strong gender studies program, and there's other things going on there. But then there's folks who do philosophy of science who also are looking who do feminist philosophy of science. And so I was just curious if there was like a particular way of thinking at Stanford that was like the Stanford school of this that, I don't know that, or perhaps I'm looking into something that's not there, but yeah, I'm curious.
I don't know if there was a Stanford school of it. There certainly was a sort of welcoming openness to the importance of studying the social dimensions of science, and a pluralistic approach to practices within the philosophy of science. Many of the philosophers of science at Stanford were engaged in collaborations with historians of science, with scientists themselves, and with theorists in areas like critical race and gender studies, and saw that as part of the practice, right? Part of the necessary expertise. I feel, in contrast to some other spaces I've been in, a place where I could do the work.
Fair enough.
And have good conversations about it.
Great. How was your time with Helen Longino?
How was what?
How was your time with studying with Helen or getting to the, I had a chance to interview her back, I don't know, maybe a few years ago, but she was obviously one of the authors that we read, you know, in intro philosophy of science courses and hear wonderful things about, you know, and so that must have, I was just curious what that was like.
Oh, I feel so lucky to have been able to work with her during that time. When I was maybe a junior or senior at Columbia, I wrote a paper for one of Philip Kitcher's classes and then spoke to him about my graduate school interests. And he said, you know, you really might be interested in Helen Longino's work. And I went over to Labyrinth Books and purchased her book, Science as a Social Practice, that very day, and The Fate of Knowledge, mm-hmm. and read them on my own, and felt quite an affinity to the range of questions that she was engaging and the creativity with which she was engaging them. I think what characterized her work for me and has continued to be important in my own work is the insistence that we can think these things together. We can think at the same time about science and ideology and science and values and science and its social dimensions. And we can think about the classic questions in philosophy of science around inference and evidence and terms like realism and objectivity and truth. That terrain has remained utterly fascinating to me. I also just appreciated how in her career she had read and listened to feminist theorists, feminist scientists, and sought in her work to serve them by theorizing what they were doing, offering methodological toolkits for the kinds of critique that they were doing, and was very inspired by how that work had traveled out of philosophy of science into practice and wider conversations.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, tell us a little bit, you've mentioned that briefly that this has permeated a bit in this approach into your work. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the work that you began doing at Stanford? And I can see a number of your publications here related to the related to genomics and other areas. But what were some of your general projects going on? And how did they develop?
Well, at Stanford, Marcus Feldman, Sandra Lee, and Barbara Koenig, sort of a group between the population geneticists there and the bioethics folks, and there were folks also at the Stanford Center for Race and Ethnic Studies, had formed right like when I arrived a group that just wanted to read and think about race and genomics. And I showed up to the first meeting and it had philosophers, historians, sociologists, ethicists, and scientists sitting at the same table.
Wow.
Tossing around ideas, debating, discussing, reading together, bringing in speakers. I rapidly became like, this is my ideal. and I rapidly became like the graduate student coordinator of this group. And,
oh, that's also fun.
For a 3-year period, we did that on an almost weekly basis. And although I came in wanting to work on sex, gender, and the brain, I was very quickly pulled over into genomics. I read everything about the history and philosophy of genomics and genetics. It became one of my fields. And when the X chromosome was sequenced in 2005, mm-hmm. I just happened to see the cover of Science from that week, read up on the key scientific articles and the wider commentary around the sequencing of the X. And I realized this is an untold story, the history of the X and Y chromosomes. It is an underanalyzed story from the perspective of gender studies of science. There are many critical, low-hanging questions around how we relate the science of the X and Y to big ideas about sex differences, and wrote a term paper on that, and was ultimately persuaded that that could be a dissertation. And so from the work on race and genomics, and I helped co-edit a volume of papers and wrote the introduction to that volume of papers that became known as Revisiting Race in a Genomic Age, which is still an important reader, I think, in the field. Sort of it really is a snapshot of that moment and the conversations that we were having about the reformulation of concepts of race difference with the arrival of the Genome Project. And many of the same frameworks for thinking about race being reformulated by the genome helped me formulate questions about sex and gender as they were being reformulated by genomic understandings of biology. And so I wrote a dissertation that was really right down the line, history and philosophy of science. My approach has always been a sort of critical case study method, examining contested claims in an area and trying to unpack the different assumptions that people bring and the role of the social in those sorts of contestations.
Fantastic. And so what, I suppose, what did you come away with? And did this become the book that ended up getting published by Chicago?
Yeah. So this became Sex Itself, The Search for Male and Female in the Human Genome. That was published in 2013. I have in general, I've written quite broadly on genomics and gender sex. I've written on sex, gender, and sexuality broadly and genetics and genomics. I more recently have written on sort of post-genomics and epigenetics and gender and sex. So in that space, I'm always thinking, always watching the literature. I've done work, you know, talking to medical students, talking to popular audiences, talking to media as new claims emerge from this area of science. So I continue to be engaged on those questions.
Fantastic. And so for those who perhaps who are in the philosophy of science or history of science, but who haven't, who are, you know, they might not be, haven't taken a course in genomics or have only you know, a cursory knowledge of this. What are some of the, perhaps the takeaways that you found from your work that are particularly relevant to perhaps the science, the study of science or the way in which science unfolds?
Oh boy, that's a big question. of course, I think there are lots of things.
Sure.
I think that one of the things, I'll just talk my way into an answer to this question.
Fair enough.
So, you know, the characterization of whole genomes and the understanding of whole genomes in relation to traits troubled the notion of the gene, the single gene for, right? And set up a whole new framework for thinking about fundamental questions of difference, of taxonomy, and also of evolution and relatedness. One of the papers that I wrote early on was why males and females are not as different as humans and chimpanzees. And this really engages this phylogenetic space that genomics brought us into, this constant set of comparisons of forms of difference at the genomic level. And there was quite a bit of slipperiness and sort of reconfirmation or sort of finding again differences and then stating that they are bigger than we ever knew. And genomics also gave a way to put numbers on that, to say, we are this different, right? This percent different, right?
Sure.
It produced a language of quantification around difference. So that is one thing to think about, this, the way that genomics provided a shared platform across many different areas of reasoning, from the genomic to the medical space just evolutionary biology and sort of theoretical biology. And as it became this shared platform, how old ideas were recast, sometimes brought it up again in an uncritical way. So a lot of the tracking was that. And then in the sort of post-genomic moment, there's been an interest in understanding the genome as a reactive, active, dynamic, interactive thing, a materiality that interacts with the environment. And my next work, which was about epigenetics and a maternal fetal programming and maternal effects during the prenatal period, really entered into those newer ways of understanding the genome as situated and the body as biosocial.
Gotcha. So this was the post-genomics work?
Well, I did with Hallam Stevens a long-term project on post-genomics where, you know, we really tried to think together about this emerging terrain of post-genomic science, if it could be called that. And then my recent book, The Maternal Imprint.
Why don't we actually turn to that, because I'm interested. So I know this is a new work. And so what, could you tell us a little bit about this particular project and what you're up to in this?
Yeah, so this book is about the idea, the persistent idea in the history of biology, that one's time in the womb leaves an imprint on development, on generations of descendants, perhaps, that it has an imprint that is akin to heredity in some sense. And it enters a very contested area around the intersection, essentially, between pregnancy and heredity. And these ideas were resurfacing in the post-genomic moment, sort of post-2010, in the form of inquiries in the area of epigenetics. And some of the most important early models for this were about early life developmental effects in the womb, in mammalian species, that is. And these claims about maternal effects, like, for example, maternal stress during pregnancy or metabolic processes during pregnancy and the lung imprint on outcomes that might range from adiposity to ADHD, from psychiatric disorders to IQ, heart disease, many associations leading to speculations were emerging. And I really wanted to understand what was simultaneously so compelling about those claims, just so interesting, right? And troubling. And so I it's a historical reconstruction of the life of that idea in the genetic era, starting with Weismann in the late 19th century and moving through several important eras of the history of genetics, alongside a reconstruction of how these ideas have played out within the sciences and in broader discussions about sex and gender maternal and paternal responsibility in each era, in reproductive politics, one might say. So that's the story. And it arrives, much of it is history, but a sort of critical, philosophically inflected historical engagement. And then the last few chapters really take a hard look at this emerging field, carefully reviewing claims in the science of prenatal fetal epigenetic programming, including claims like those from the Dutch hunger winter studies that are well known, or major studies of the relationship between maternal stress and offspring outcomes. And building some arguments around this idea that I call cryptic causality, that I see as an emerging formation in the elite molecular life sciences more broadly, but particularly characterizes reasoning in this field.
Fascinating. This looks like an excellent, I'm looking a little bit at the reviews, and this seems like such a large story and something incredible to unpack. This looks like some excellent. I don't know what to say. So is this? So I guess one of the things I had mentioned is this. I was curious of how much this is connected and how much has been in either in connection with your work in the gender sci lab. and you're heading up that. So is this the kind of work in doing this in this HPS kind of work? Is this something that you're working with other scholars to inform your thinking, to look into, or I'm curious in terms of its relation to this lab, and if you could tell us a little bit about that as well.
Sure. The GenderSci lab was founded a few years ago, and it came out of 10 years of collaboration between myself and some evolutionary biologists at Harvard who had been meeting regularly to read sort of feminist work at the intersection of our field. And we just started writing together organically and having so much fun that when I got tenure and could ask for resources and imagine what my life would be like as an intellectual going forward, I said, well, I'm going to institutionalize this. And so we dreamed up the lab, which I now direct and has 25 members, mostly graduate students and early career folks from across the disciplines, from the life sciences to the quantitative social sciences, to the health sciences, to philosophy and history of biology and gender studies, of course. We meet and we strategically take on big claims in the area of sex and gender science, contested claims, claims that have not yet been closely looked at by an interdisciplinary team like ours. And we're interested in characterizing and ameliorating bias and hype in this field, and in developing methodological toolkits that others can adopt, and particularly that scientists can bring into their methodologies to think critically about the construction of sex and gender difference claims.
And I see this big paper. Yeah, so one of the most recent papers, What's Really Behind the Gender Gap in COVID-19 Deaths. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so when COVID came, our lab was you know, like everyone, we were just sort of thrown back, unsure what role we could play or what we could do. And we retooled. We began in April of 2020, the U.S. state COVID-19 gender sex tracker. So every Monday we pulled data from public health agencies across the U.S. to characterize sex and gender disparities in COVID cases and COVID deaths. And so from that, we constructed the largest, most comprehensive longitudinal data set. And the story that it shows is substantial local heterogeneity in the degree, the magnitude, and direction of the sex disparity. And so this recent paper is characterizing, is our big data paper coming out of that. But like we always do, we insistently do the theory and methodology alongside it. And we really are characterizing heterogeneity in these patterns, which shows that something that is often in the COVID discourse been interpreted as driven by biological variables, that is the overall higher mortality rate for men compared to women during the pandemic, is actually responsive to local contextual factors, either exacerbated or ameliorated by it, and therefore is unlikely to be solely or even primarily driven by innate biology. And so a lot of our work has been about critically interrogating that hypothesis and emphasizing the importance of social factors to apparent sex disparities in the COVID pandemic.
And fascinating. And so this, I mean, I'm just impressed by the approach as well of a team of folks like yourself coming in and doing yeah, this kind of, I mean, this kind of projects. And it seems like I see, especially on their website, I love the cartoon of environmental factors winning a arm wrestling match against, I imagine, the biological factors. So is that kind of the, is that a lot of the approach is like looking for cases in the literature and the research where perhaps environmental or contextual factors are not given their day, or areas where claims perhaps that are overly nature focused. Is that kind of the general approach, or is it more to kind of suss out perhaps just areas where those claims are being made, but it's they're murky or not quite clear?
Yeah, there's still a shocking number of arenas in which claims about sex differences in health outcomes only look at biological factors that might drive those outcomes, without considering the social dimensions. That remains sort of okay in this field is something that we're trying to transform. We would like to see a real sex and gender science. And so, yes, we're trying to develop clear case studies, clear models for doing that work without ever denying the importance of biological sex-related variables. But emphasizing that they must always be studied in context and with attention to variation. And so, yes, in this case of COVID, that proved to be really true. And we hope that the empirical as well as the conceptual work that came out of this can help turn the tide a little, course correct in that area.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing a little bit about that. I know we're just about out of time, so why don't I jump ahead to the last question, which is, what do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science, or if you'd like, history and philosophy of science today?
I think that these fields really are being called upon to diversify. These fields still, if you go to a conference in these fields, they do not represent the world. And as long as they don't represent the world, the knowledge that they're producing is inadequate. Many, many people are working to make this happen, we need to accelerate that work. And critically examine our field. And it's not just about adding in people with different racial, ethnic, gender, and other backgrounds. It is about opening ourselves to the kinds of questions that are urgent to their lives and that come from their experiences. And right now, that is really still not happening, I think, in our fields. And that's, it may not be good for me to say this coming now. I'm perched in a history of science department, but I very much feel a fidelity to philosophy of science as well. Philosophy is particularly problematic in this sense. So I think that's the highest priority.
Getting a sense of diverse. So yeah, representing I like how that is said, is that actually representing the world is another way of putting it. And I think, my hope is that I think there are other historians and philosophers of science who would certainly agree with you. I definitely agree with you. And it seems like your work in this particular lab itself is definitely contributing to that end. Our hope is that, I don't know. I mean, I guess, is there any particular... are there any particular actions if you have early scholars or folks, grad students or folks who are hearing this kind of advice, what could they do to that end, to go into work, to look at and find the problems that would be, or to frame them in a way that would be representative of the world?
I think it is a real challenge because it's one thing for those of us who want to create spaces intended for everyone, which is, some of the work we are doing in the lab. And it's another for people to really feel that the space is a safe an inclusive one for their flourishing. And intentions are one thing. And the true carrying out of that feeling and in a consistent way is the big, big challenge. I think therefore, accelerating the development of leaders in our field who are from those backgrounds, who can then help to mentor and create those kinds of spaces and collaborations and build out these new areas of philosophy of science that there will need to be. We can't expect that the field will stay the same when new people are added to it. And so it's going to be a big process. It has happened in other fields. And so that makes me optimistic.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Dr. Sarah Richardson. Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to share a little bit about your story. I'm very impressed with the work that you've done and that you continue to do. And it's really exciting to see. And I look forward to following along and definitely checking out this your new book, The Maternal Imprint. So thank you. Thank you so much again. I appreciate you taking the time. It was wonderful to speak with you. Hope you have a great rest of the day and good luck in teaching this term.
Thank you so much, Nick. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Okay. Have a great rest of the day. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye.